I hopped a streetcar up to Harlem, then walked over to 108th Street. A uniformed patrolman halfway down the block asked to see my badge. Hey folks, how are you? This is Keith Tolley, your volunteer broadcaster, bringing you the Mystery Hour, right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. A treat to have you with me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, author R.T. Lawton, bring us our first story, and it's called Murder Alley. Here I was, minding my own business, with my feet up on my desk in the Vice Squad bullpen and enjoying a morning cup of burnt coffee, laced with a dose of shine from the flask normally hidden in my bottom desk drawer. And that's when the lieutenant's dog robber invaded my peace and quiet. We all call him Peach Fuzz, 'cause he wasn't shaving yet, at least as far as we could tell. The kid didn't much like the name, but we were careful not to use it in front of the lieutenant, who seemed to have a soft spot for the youngster. I still don't know how the kid ever got onto the police force, as naive and unseasoned as he was. Must have been related to one of the higher-ups, or else had a good rabbi somewhere in the city politics. Well, in any case, I knew it wasn't going to be good for me when Peaches came to a halt in front of my desk. Detective Everett Maitland, he said in a voice that went up and down in pitch like he hadn't made up his mind about puberty yet. The lieutenant's pissed at you. I gave a deep sigh. All right, what'd I do this time? He lowered the volume of his voice. The precinct captain rigorously chewed out our lieutenant because you raided a certain speakeasy? Oh, yeah, and which one would that be?
One that's on the list of heavy contributors to the Policeman's Benefit Association, as you well know.
I think what you're trying to say is that the owner of the speakeasy pays the captain's bagman every month in order to operate without police interference?
That's not how the captain sees it. As of now, you are officially on loan to the Harlem Homicide Squad for 1 week, out of sight, out of mind.
I don't know the first thing about working homicides.
Well, the lieutenant says you'll just have to learn as you go. Consider it as on-the-job training.
Why Harlem?
'Cause the Harlem Homicide guys are currently swamped with dead bodies up there and need all the help that they can get.
And now, I was wishing I had put more shine in my coffee.
Your first case and victim are waiting for you in Murder Alley, Peach Fuzz continued. I'm sure you've heard of the place.
Well, yeah, who hasn't?
You'll find your new partner already at the crime scene.
I took a healthy swig of burnt coffee to keep my temper on hold before speaking. All right, so it's my turn in the barrel, is it? That's when he got a nasty grin on his fresh young face, and I wanted more than ever to paste him one in the chops.
Well, it's funny you should use the words, in the barrel.
Why's that?
Because that's where your victim is.
I swung my feet off the desk and stood up. He must have read my intentions, because he started moving sideways and began talking faster.
The lieutenant says you need to get your good-for-nothing butt up to Harlem right now.
Then he quickly added, his words, not mine. Turning on his heels, he beat a hasty retreat. The story was that some detective on the homicide squad years ago had started calling the area Murder Alley because of all the killings there during the Castellamare's War. After that, the name stuck. In reality, it wasn't an alley at all. It was an uneven cobblestone street with a row of ramshackle two- or three-story wooden buildings constructed from sheet iron, packing crates, and house wreckage. They lined both sides of East 108th Street up in East Harlem. Some of them had once seen service as horse stables. Others served as blacksmithies, feed and grain stores, butcher shops, or whatever business was needed.
with living quarters being on the upper floors. This so-called Murder Alley ran one block from 1st Avenue to 2nd Avenue, an area that produced more than its share of killings, most of them being gang members from the old La Mano Nera, the Neapolitan Camorra, and the Sicilian Mafia in their struggle for dominance. Best you could say was that some of them spaghetti eaters were still around plying their trade. I hopped a streetcar up to Harlem, then walked over to 108th Street. A uniformed patrolman halfway down the block asked to see my badge. He got kind of a smirk on his face after he found out who I was. Yeah, you'll be working with Detective Copeland, he said and pointed across the street. Crap. I'd heard about Copeland before. According to rumors in the precinct, he had 3 strikes against him as to being a partner on a dead body investigation or on any other crime for that matter. The guy was thick-headed, lazy, and totally corrupt. But, as I would come to find out later, he also had an animal cunning and instinct for survival. With most partners, it was understood that you covered each other, but with this guy, you had to watch out for yourself. He was the kind of yahoo who would stick a knife in your back and accuse you of stealing the silverware. Some days, it seemed, I couldn't catch a break. I walked over to where Copeland was standing with his hands on his hips. He seemed to be staring at a wooden barrel in one corner of a 3-walled room that had probably stabled horses in its time, and from the smell of it, maybe still did. A pair of trouser-covered legs were standing almost straight up from the open top of the large barrel. The stockinged feet had one shoe on, the other shoe lay on its side by the base of the barrel. Looked to me like the victim put up a struggle before he died, or else somebody dragged him across the dirt floor after the murder and stuffed him upside down in the barrel. Thus, one shoe on, one shoe off. What do we got here, Copeland? The victim leave that illegal drinking establishment behind me, stagger across the alley, then trip and fall into that barrel? Copeland turned his head just enough to look at me over his shoulder. The chief asked the precinct to send us their best, Maitland, and they sent us you. They must be hard up for good investigators. I tell you, Copeland, we've been together 5 seconds, and already you tried to insult me. What kind of relationship is that to have with your fellow detective on a murder investigation? You'll never move up the ranks with that kind of attitude. I, for one, didn't ask for you, so stay out of my way. Fine, I said as I dusted off the top of a nearby barrel with a folded handkerchief from my hip pocket. I'll just make myself comfortable here while you look for clues to solve the case. Copeland merely grunted and continued staring at the body. I entertained myself by watching the local newspaper photographer taking photos while he moved around the victim's barrel, looking for the best shot. When he was finished, I motioned him over and kept my voice low. Tell you what, Murphy, when we get the stiff out of the barrel, you take a photograph of his face, run the photo in your morning paper, and ask anybody that recognizes him to give me a call. Well, now, what about Copeland? I handed Murphy my card. I'm not sure Copeland can read. Murphy looked the card over. And in return, you'll give me the inside scoop? I spread my hands in a welcoming gesture. We're a team, Murph. Okay, he said and walked off to one side. After a couple of minutes of silence, I finally asked Copeland, why don't you haul the corpse out of there and see about identifying him? Maybe he's got a wallet with some identification in it, and we can get this case started. I've already started the case. Now I'm waiting for the coroner to show up. He can handle the body. If you're afraid of getting your expensive suit dirty, well, we can just tip the barrel over and drag him out. I doubt the dead guy'll mind. Copeland didn't even bother to grunt this time, so we hung around, waiting an hour for the coroner to show up. When he did, he looked a little frazzled, like he'd been missing sleep lately. I gave him a friendly grin. "Hey, Sam, how you doing these days?"
"Ev, what are you doing here? Homicide's a little out of your bailiwick."
"Well, the chief asked for our best detective to assist Copeland with his death investigation, so here I am. Seems they're overloaded with corpses these days." Sam looked from me to Copeland and back again.
"I see. Well, then, have you identified the victim yet?"
"Well, I was just telling Copeland that we should tip the barrel over and drag the body out and see if he's got an ID on him."
"Well, that sounds like a good idea. Why don't one of you help me with the barrel?"
Copeland didn't move. I stepped over and gave Sam a hand. We tipped the barrel over so the body would come out on its back, the 2 feet now pointed toes up.
"One shoe off and one shoe on," said Sam. "Reminds me of a nursery rhyme."
I chuckled. Copeland didn't so much as crack a smile. I guess nobody read him nursery rhymes when he was a kid. Or maybe leading a life of corruption just naturally made him a sourpuss. His loss. The coroner and I each took an ankle and started pulling the body out of the barrel. Sam paused to sniff the air.
"You know, something here smells like molasses."
I had already noticed the painted stencil on the barrel. "Yeah, it's from the Boston Molasses Company," I said, and then pointed my thumb at a certain building across the alley. "Clutch Hand Morello's Mob has a distillery in the basement of that speakeasy. They buy molasses from Boston, ferment it, distill the juice into the form of sugarcane rum, and store it in oak quarter casks. The speak on the main floor of the building then sells it to its patrons as rum cocktails."
"Heh, sounds like you've been inside before."
"Yeah, 4 or 5 times. The booze business is lucrative enough they keep reopening their speak shortly after we raid it."
"Well," Sam replied, "I don't mind a drink myself from time to time. In my business, it helps take the edge off. Allows me to sleep better at night."
Before I could ask him about the sleep better thing, the corpse slid all the way out of the barrel. Large clumps of sawdust compacted with dried blood fell away from the upper part of the body. From the mess on his shirt, I couldn't immediately tell if the killer or killers had cut his throat or stabbed him to death. At least he was well-dressed in a brown tweed suit with a yellow vest. The newspaper photographer moved in for his facial shot. I rolled the barrel off a short distance and turned it upside down to empty the rest of its contents. A dark red shower of clumped sawdust, liberally sprinkled with black cigar butts and snuffed-out cigarettes, poured out. I poked around in the mess with the toe of my shoe to see if there was anything else of interest before I went back over to Sam and the body. Sam was going through the guy's pockets and in the process of pulling out a worn leather wallet, a lace handkerchief, and a watch fob on a broken gold chain. The wallet contained a couple of dollars, but there was no identification on the man. Copeland bent down over the corner and stuck out his hand.
"Gimme," he said. "I'll need that for evidence."
He went through the wallet, searching for hidden pockets. Nothing else was found. Folding the dollar bills, he stuffed them in his vest pocket and then turned his attention to the leather fob on the broken chain. Finding it to be of no great value, he dropped it in the dirt along with the lace handkerchief and empty wallet.
"I'm going back to the office to enter this into evidence," he said.
He was already turned and walking away as I asked him a question.
"Hey, Copeland,
what do you want me to do?"
"Go talk to some witnesses," he threw back over his shoulder.
I looked around. There was nobody else here except me, the coroner, the newspaper photographer, 2 stretcher bearers who had just arrived from the morgue, and the guy about to get a ride in the meat wagon. So I picked up the abandoned leather watch fob and examined it. There appeared to be the faint image of a cross overlaid by a crown pressed into the leather. I'd seen this symbol before, somewhere in France during the Great War, but couldn't remember what it meant. When I picked up the lace handkerchief, it gave off the smell of cheap perfume. I put them both in my suit coat pocket. For good measure, I took the empty wallet, too. After the coroner pronounced the victim as being dead and then saw the stiff off in the meat wagon, I made him an offer. "Copeland told me to interview some witnesses," I said, "so let me buy you a drink." Sam looked at me, then at the speakeasy across the alley.
You mean that place?"
I nodded. He thought about it for a moment, then,
you know what, why not?
We crossed the alley and I knocked on the door. A slot in the door slid open and a pair of eyes stared out at us. "Hey, George," I said. "I don't know your new password. Just open the door and let us in."
"You raiding a place, Ev?"
"No, not this time. But I do have a thirsty friend here."
"Well, okay, as long as you promise this ain't a raid."
The peep slot slid closed, and I heard the door unlock. It was a little dark inside, with a few rough-hewn tables, some sturdy chairs, and layers of sawdust covering the floor. Much of their sawdust had black cigar butts and snuffed-out cigarette stubs mixed in with it. Yep, this was the right place. George relocked the door and led us over to the bar counter.
"Hey, what'll you have?"
"My friend will have something with rum in it," I said, "and I'm on a case, so I'll have a glass of water for now." As George moved down the bar toward an oak quarter cask, I caught him making a surreptitious movement with his hand to someone that had to be in the back corner of the saloon. Nothing else happened, so I assumed the movement meant something like, "Don't worry, I've got this." I waited a few minutes before turning to look behind me. There, at a table, sat several gangsters I knew from the Clutch Hand Sicilian mob. Clutch Hand Morello himself wasn't there, but I recognized a big man named Bull. He looked strong enough to have stuffed the dead guy into the barrel by himself. Interesting. I turned back to the bar. George served up two rum cocktails and a glass of slightly gray water.
"Your first one's on the house, but our waters around here is not so good. You might want to kill the germs," George said as he slid one of the cocktails in front of me.
A black speck of something floated by on the oily gray surface, so I decided to skip the water. "By the way, George," I said, "you didn't happen to see a guy wearing a brown tweed suit and a yellow vest in here last night, did you?" His eyes darted toward the back corner where the gangster sat.
"Nah, you know, I don't remember," he replied. "We were pretty busy last night."
George had a felony court case coming up in a few months, and his mouthpiece was offering to trade his cooperation for less time on any sentence. So I dropped the level of my voice and acquired a more menacing tone. "You might want to remember this guy, George, else I can return with a fire axe and a squad of detectives to tear this place apart and ask you some embarrassing questions out loud in front of those guys sitting in the corner." George poured two more cocktails and placed them in front of us. This time, he took my money.
Give me a minute to think," he said as he scratched his head. I do seem to remember something now about that yellow vest. He had a gold pocket watch on a chain. Sat for a while with Bull and the crew having a confab of some sorts for a couple of hours. Best I can recall, he claimed to be a friend of a friend back in Chicago or something like that. Then Bull got a telephone call and had to leave.
What was the call about?
I don't know. I went to the other end of the bar to give him some privacy. It's not healthy to listen in on their business.
But
Bull got all squinty-eyed and kept staring at the guy in the yellow vest during the call. When Bull didn't return to the table, then the feller in the yellow vest got up and left by himself.
You're a good man, George. I'll see what I can do about your troubles downtown.
Hey, I'd appreciate it. Just don't say nothing to those guys.
He nodded toward the back corner. Sam and I finished our drinks and left. The next morning, I was once again sitting at my desk with my high-top shoes on, the wood, and savoring my second cup of burnt coffee, enhanced with a couple of splashes of what the doctor ordered, when Peach Fuzz approached. He was leading a stout lady who had a build like she worked in a steel mill. She was wearing what had to be a homemade dress of solid black and a small round straw hat encircled by a wide black ribbon on the crown. The scowl on her face was stern enough to convert heathens by the dozens, and, yes, she did have a family Bible clutched in her hand as if she was armed with it everywhere she went. Peaches stopped in front of my desk, drew himself up, and presented the woman.
"Detective Maitland," he said, "Mrs. Jones here believes she recognizes the photo of the deceased gentleman found in the barrel and claims she is supposed to talk to you."
I took my shoes off the desk and stood. "Thank you, Peach. Leroy, I can handle everything from here." He marched off to the swinging gate in the low rail separating the bullpen from passers-by, walked through the opening, and sat one haunch on the low rail where he could listen to what got said. He may have been cleaning his fingernails with a penknife, but I knew that wasn't why he was sitting there. The little rat. I pulled a chair away from another desk and brought it around to the side of my desk for Mrs. Jones to sit in. All this time I was careful not to breathe coffee and shine on her. It was a feeling I had about my new visitor.
"I believe the man in the newspaper photograph is my husband," she began. "I would like to see him to be sure."
Yes, ma'am. Let me make a few notes and then I'll take you right over to where he's laid out." I grabbed a pad of paper and scrounged for a pencil. "You say you think this man is your husband? What can you tell me about him?"
"His name is Taggett Jones. Most people call him Tag or Lightfoot."
Lightfoot? That's an interesting nickname.
"Well, you see, we are both members of the Anti-Saloon League. He got that nickname when he was infiltrating some of the bootleggers' organizations in Oklahoma and then exposing their leaders."
"Oh, so he was an undercover operative?"
"Yes, and about to expose a group here in New York City."
"A brave and dedicated man," I said.
"Why, you could say that," she replied,
but seemed to have some reservations on that score. "There are some items that Detective Copeland entered into evidence," I ventured. "However, there are some other personal items we found on him that you may wish to have, if you like. I can turn them over to you now." She nodded her assent. I took the wallet out of my desk drawer and handed it to her. She went through it, much like Copeland had. Finding it empty, she laid it on the desk. Next, I handed her the watch fob with the broken chain.
"Where's the watch?" she inquired. "It was gold and should be worth something, not to mention the sentimental value," she added quickly.
"The watch was missing," I replied, "but I was wondering about the symbols on the leather fob."
"Oh, something to do with the York Rites and the Masons," she said, and tossed the fob and broken chain on top of the wallet. "The same symbols were engraved on the lid of the watch. What else do you have?"
Something about her attitude made me hesitate for a moment, but I decided to take a chance. What the heck? The man was already dead. I drew out the handkerchief. "I assume this scented handkerchief is yours. He must have kept it close to him to remind him of you in times of peril." She took one sniff of that cheap perfume on the hanky and tore it into two pieces. Then she threw both pieces on the floor.
"That little sneak," she exclaimed. "I've known for some time that he was seeing that little hussy of his on the side. This just proves me right."
I tried to calm her down, but finally decided to just let her wind down on her own. No way was I going to ask her who the little hussy was and get her riled up all over again.
"Oh, he got his just desserts when they killed him.
Those were her final words. I had been smart enough not to get into an argument with her on the subject of alcohol, religion, and hussies, so I sure wasn't going to start with capital punishment for fooling around on the side. By now, Peach Fuzz had deserted his post on the rail. I presumed he had seen and heard enough to know it was in his best interest to hurry up and vanish in case I tried to task him with taking her somewhere like the morgue to see her faithless husband. The coward. There was no way for me to get out of it, so I walked her over to the morgue myself and dumped her on Sam. Hopefully he would remember me kindly, since I'd bought him 2 drinks the day before. No sense in me going to Copeland's office. He'd just shuffle me off on some useless job, so I decided to keep interviewing witnesses like he had ordered yesterday. To my way of thinking, that meant paying a visit to the pawn shops nearest to Murder Alley. A little shoe leather investigating, as they say. 6 shops into my quest, I hit pay dirt. Isidore's pawn shop was squeezed in between a meat market and a greasy spoon diner. Me and Izzy had a fairly good working relationship, most of the time. The little overhead bell tinkled when I opened the door and Izzy came out of the back room thinking he had a customer. "Oh, hello, Everett, and here I thought I was going to make some money." "Well, you never know, Iz. Why don't you show me some pocket watches?" He reached into a glass-topped counter and brought out a wooden box. There must have been 2 dozen pocket watches in the box. I picked up one of the watches and inspected it. "Nope." Put it down and went on to the next one.
You looking for a gift for somebody? I can probably make you a deal."
"Maybe. I haven't decided yet." After I had gone through the contents of the entire box, I looked up at him. "These are all cheap watches," I said. "What have you got in gold? Something a little more expensive?"
"I got one that just came in yesterday. I was cleaning it up in the back room. Let me get it for you."
He turned and walked to the back. Quietly, I went in behind him so that when he turned around with a watch in his hand, I was right there.
Everett, I don't usually let customers come in the back room."
I took the gold pocket watch from his hand. It had the same cross and crown symbols engraved on the lid as were on the leather watch fob.
"I'm just thinking about your safety here, Iz. You don't want some customer coming in the shop and seeing you handing over evidence in a murder case, do you?"
"Murder case? No, not me. I don't know anything about any murder."
"I didn't think you did, Iz. So just tell me who you got this watch from, and I'll be on my way."
I could see him thinking over his options, so I prodded him a little.
"Iz, you need this pawn shop to be open so you can feed your family, don't you?"
"Yeah,
and you don't want a bunch of harness cops going through your inventory and asking embarrassing questions, do you?"
No.
I open my hands, palms out. "So give."
"Oh, okay. It was a big man known as Bull. He brought it in yesterday afternoon, but I don't know nothing about any murder."
I stuck the watch in my jacket pocket. "This'll have to go with me, Iz. It's evidence in the case."
"Will I get it back?"
Don't think so, Iz. When the court case is over, this'll go to the widow." "You don't want the poor woman to be totally destitute after the untimely loss of her husband, do you?" I could tell Lizzie was torn between the prospect of losing money versus coming up with the appropriate answer, so I left him alone to contemplate his sins. The next morning, I got an arrest warrant for one Tommaso Pietto, also known as The Bull, and started assembling my raid team. When everything was ready, I put in a call to Copeland and brought him up to date. He declined to go along on the raid and arrest, said he had something important to attend to, but he would be at the Harlem Homicide Squad office for the subsequent press conference, and I could attend if I wanted. With that taken care of, we loaded up into cars and drove up to Murder Alley.
We parked on First Avenue and walked around the corner with two men carrying the battering ram. I knocked on the door to the speak. George slid the eye slot open. He saw me and said, "Hey, Ev, it's you again. Are you raiding or drinking this time?" "We're raiding." "Hey, sorry, Ev," he said. "Then I can't let you in." "Well, you might want to step back from the door then, George." Then I motioned for the men with the battering ram to step forward to do their job. They took down the door with one swing, stepped back, dropped the ram in the dirt, and drew their revolvers. They'd be the last ones in and would guard our backs. I was first in, closely followed by the officer carrying a rapid-fire weapon. There was something about the effect of that .45 caliber Thompson machine gun that made most men dive for cover and wave the white flag rather than stand and fight. Bull wasn't one of them. Caught halfway between the corner where the phone was and his usual back corner table, he already had his .38 automatic out and tried to shoot. The officer with the Thompson quickly took care of that situation with one burst. Brass casings flew through the air, clattering across the wood floor. The atmosphere now had a sharp and sweet tang to it, and my ears rang. After that, the rest of the gangsters at the table in the corner were easy to deal with. I used the telephone to call Sam and request the services of the meat wagon. The next call went to Murphy. After all, I owed him one. George sat in a chair behind the bar and tried to pull himself together. I poured him a rum cocktail, and he downed it in one go. Then he held out his glass for another, so I poured again. Mostly he muttered to himself as if he was trying to get the events straight in his head. The best I caught of his monologue was that Bull had gotten a phone call just before we showed up. Someone had warned Bull we were coming. He and his boys were getting ready to scram when the door came down and the shooting started. Something for my mind to work out later. Half the raid team took the prisoners, except for George, back to the precinct, while the other half went downstairs to wreak havoc on the distillery. I used the downtime to fill an empty metal flask I found behind the bar with rum from one of the oak quarter casks while I waited for Sam to arrive. When he did, he stepped over the pieces of broken door shortly before the men in the meat wagon showed. "Well, Ev," he lamented, "you're certainly having a productive time in homicide. Not that I need the business, you understand." "You are still looking a little peaked there," I replied. "Let me pour you a drink to take the edge off." Sam peered at George, gesturing softly at the air. "You ever figure out who killed the man in the barrel?" Sam asked me as he held out his glass for another fill-up. "Yes and no," was my answer. "How's that?" Sam inquired. "The main killer is lying there on the floor."
"Oh, you mean Bull?"
"Yep. He pawned the dead man's pocket watch at Izzy's pawn shop shortly after the murder. Unfortunately, Bull is now dead, so we won't have him around to tell us who the second killer was."
"He probably wouldn't have told you anyway."
"Yeah, you could be right, Sam. But I'm willing to bet your next drink in this establishment that it was a woman who called Bull the day of the murder and let him know that the man in the yellow vest, what he was up to."
"A woman involved in the killing, huh?"
"Yep. Mrs. Jones, that stern woman I brought into your office, she knew her husband was cheating on her with some hussy, as she put it. So I suspect that she telephoned Bull and spilled the beans."
"But you can't prove it."
You're right again, Sam. However, I'm willing to bet my next drink in this establishment that Copeland was the one who called Bull today to tell him we were coming for him, knowing that Bull would go down hard."
"But you can't prove that either, can you?"
I shook my head, then poured us another drink. When both were full, I clinked Sam's glass and offered him a toast. "May the good Lord protect us from scorned women."
"And from the backstabbers working amongst us,"
Sam added.
Here we go to our next story from the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine this time. Lori Rader Day is our author, and the story is called The Woman from Rolling Stone. They were expecting Demi Walters from Rolling Stone any minute, and until she showed, Sean couldn't relax. His attention darted between the glass front doors of the gallery and the details in the room, lighting that chiseled dramatic shadows through the room and across faces. Past hors d'oeuvres from the chef de moment, the right tone, the right people. His fingers tapped his thighs, a frantic tempo out of beat with everything in the room, including the soundtrack. The right music, of course. Nova Tyler's otherworldly voice rose to a high trill, angels singing over an abandoned abbey, then swung to a howl, a woodland creature with its leg caught in a trap. Nova's tracks were playing at the perfect volume. The song braided itself in and around the cacophony of voices, sometimes disappearing beneath the noise only to re-exert itself, surprising as a car alarm. Nova's music made Sean think of terrible stories he'd always assumed weren't true, of ancient rites maybe that ended in bloodshed, and other history, including his own. Bloodshed of a different type. Sean could admit that Nova Tyler was the kind of taste one had to acquire. He just needed these people to acquire it tonight. Around him, everyone who was anyone in the taste-making business were arranging themselves casually in case they were captured in the background of a photo that landed in next month's issue of Spin. But across the room, the doorway stood empty. The song overhead ended abruptly, and before the crowd could rush in to fill the void, a pair of champagne flutes clinked together, a strange melody. All the industry people in the room raised their chins one ear higher than the other, collectively recognizing the tone, G sharp. Even the catering waitress, several years too old for the job and awkward in a bow tie and cummerbund made for a man's straight waist, paused and tilted her head at the glass's tune. She held an empty silver tray in one hand, her fingernails painted, dark, chipped. Her graying ponytail hung slack over her shoulder. "You're watching the door color?" Sean turned to find Les Jenkins at his elbow. Jenkins led the merchandising team for the label, which made no sense. He was the human equivalent of the color Sean had learned from one of those home improvement shows Kayla always used to watch. Grayish. Not really a color, but its absence. At the thought of Kayla, Sean looked around to see if he could catch the waitress's eye. He'd been holding off, waiting for the woman from Rolling Stone, but what the heck. It wasn't champagne, it was the illusion of champagne, pink and sparkling, just enough bubbles to rise prettily in glasses for social media. "So," Sean said, "I'm watching the door, what about it?" Jenkins had chosen something stronger than the sparkling nonsense for himself, a thin dark line in a short glass that sloshed a bit as he gestured. "Were you hoping all this would smoke her out?" Jenkins said. Sean scanned the room again for the woman from Rolling Stone and for any signs of listening pleasure among his guests. If not for the free champagne, he thought, how many of these people would already be making their excuses? "All this?" Sean said. "You mean a release party 30 years in the making? We're making Nova a legend. She'll be as famous as she always deserved to be." "But you hoped, right?" Jenkins said. The dark line of his drink was thinner. "That she might show up?" 30 years ago, Nova Tyler had put down a few stunning tracks, found the industry not to her liking, and walked away. Simply slipped into the ether. Would a world premiere of Nova Tyler's life's work draw her out after all this time? Well, he hadn't hoped. He had speculated,
but that wasn't the same thing. The legal team had done their darndest to track her down. No lead too small and unlikely. No relative or old acquaintance too distant. But every trail led back to the same dead end. No one had seen her. No one who would admit to it anyway. The woman's entire existence had been reduced to a police file and a handful of songs. But what did it matter? If she was out there somewhere, or her bones were turning to dust on some forest floor or under a vacant lot, Nova Tyler could still be a triumph. He could make her one.
"I'm saving all my hopes for the music's reception," Sean said, this time scouring the room for the waitress. Could he not get a drink at his own party?
"You know, for the press. Did you catch the piece on our girl on NPR yesterday?"
"The mystery alone will move some units," Jenkins said. Sean couldn't tell if Jenkins was agreeing with him or ignoring him.
"National Public Radio, Jenkins," Sean said. "When's the last time one of our artists landed that kind of coverage, living or dead?"
"Did you hire a sleuth?" Jenkins said.
He slurred and missed the word by a few yards.
"Sleuth?" He tried to... "Detective, you must have."
Now Sean glanced around for signs of Jenkins' wife. Kayla had poured him into a cab a time or two at functions like this. At the door, a few coats were being gathered. And where was Demi? He'd have to tap the side of his glass soon, make some remarks, if he could get his hands on a glass.
"We did our due diligence," Sean said tersely. "The rightful heirs are well compensated."
Sean remembered then his first meeting with the family years back now. Nova's mother had a dark freckle under her right eye, nearly the shape of a heart. A beauty mark, they would have called it in the 40s. One of the many physical traits she had passed down to Nova, where the freckle was perfect, a punctuation mark on Nova's raw beauty. That image would hold now, just as she had been, forever young, forever desirable. Oh, okay. He had hoped. He could admit that to himself. If Nova had shown her face here tonight, they could have exploded the myth, booked the morning TV circuit, watched the charts. They could have made some more music, gone on tour, sold some shirts. On the mother, the beauty mark swam in the dark, sleepless hollow under her eyes. She'd lost whatever elusive something that Nova had, if she ever had it, but the mother was tough and uncompromising on terms. She wouldn't even negotiate with him, wouldn't tango. He had to wait until she died to approach the family again. There was a brother, dim bulb, but far more interested in profits. Nova's voice rose through the speakers to a keening wail, and Sean took another reading of the room. Was anyone getting it? The first time he'd heard Nova. Maybe he hadn't gotten it either. It was Kayla who'd brought Nova's music into their house, where it had become part of the soundtrack of their lives. They'd fought to it, made love to it, well, fought to it mostly in the end. There, across the room, the waitress in the ill-fitting cummerbund had returned from the black hole she'd fallen into, but her tray was still empty, zero drinks. Ugh. She stood still in the swirl of the room, tray aloft, chin dipped to her chest. Was she talking to herself? Was she listening? Sean dared to think that if the waitress heard something in the music worth pausing to listen to, the others might too. He cast around the room for signs of life. They weren't listening. They were blah-blahing, only listening to the sound of their own chatter and laughter, drinking this profit margin of his. The door opened, but only to let a few of his guests out. He felt a flare of impatience to get out of here, too. What was he doing? What was the point? The room was overstuffed with hack media journalists and social media influencers, waiting to be told if they liked the music or not. The rest of the guest list was made up of the bottom feeders from all the rival labels, and his own, who hoped
his gamble would send him tumbling. Room fillers who would angle for his job if the world wasn't ready for Nova Tyler. The song ended. The crowd didn't register it except at the center of the room. The waitress came back to life. The ponytail slipped from her shoulders as she ducked expertly out of the range of event photographers' cameras and swept off with her tray. Sean pinned his hopes on her. Maybe she would bring drinks. Maybe she had heard something she liked. Sean used to say to his talent, to up-and-coming producers and to A&R reps, to anyone who would listen to him, that if one person was moved by the music, they put it out. They had done their jobs. One person listening and hearing, really hearing. Did he still believe that? He hadn't said it in a while, in years, longer. One person wasn't enough, though. That was the truth. In music, in sales, in life, maybe one person could be enough. A tray of drinks appeared within reach, held by another waiter, another cummerbund. Sean grabbed at one and threw back half, and grabbed another before the tray was empty or across the room again. Ah, screw it. The woman from Rolling Stones wasn't coming. She would have gotten it. Demi Walters would have heard Nova's music, her voice, and she would have recognized it, like the cry of her own child down the hall, like the sound of your own suffering normally swallowed. Maybe it was him. Maybe he was wrong about Nova. He'd been wrong before. He sank the second glass. Terrible sweet stuff, like the crap Kayla used to buy. Maybe he was the one going through the motions, not hearing, no longer truly in the room, even when he was in the room. He'd been accused of that before. He laughed and saw Jenkins squint in his direction. And maybe he had only chased the deal for Nova's music because he couldn't let her mother's refusal stand. Because he couldn't lose. What would losing look like? Like giving up, like being given up on. He had been hoping, he realized, but not in the way Jenkins thought. He glanced toward the empty doorway. A new song started up, one of Nova's own favorites, the brother had said. The song was too long for radio, sad and reaching high to low and back again. Impossible to predict, to love, to sing along with, to hum. No one had liked it for the single. He'd lost that argument. Nova had written it for her mother, as a matter of fact, and he loved it. More than that, he got it. It was about mistakes, about ignorance and decisions of the heart, about love wasted. He got it, okay? Why hadn't Mother Tyler been able to trust him that someday, in a room like this one, people would listen to and appreciate Nova finally? Sean gazed over the room, forgetting to look for the woman from Rolling Stone. The mother, now buried. The other family, the brother and his pie-faced wife, not willing to travel from the boonies, from their small lives. Oh, but Nova. The tiny flame he'd been harboring within himself that Nova might show tonight flickered unsteadily and threatened to gutter out. No artist in the world wouldn't show up to see their name come finally to glory. He had worked with the worst of them, the tiniest little dicks, the most quarrelsome nutjobs, the most ungrateful pieces of crap the industry have ever produced, the ones who believed that commerce had no place in the act of creation, or wanted everyone to believe they thought so. But every one of them had attended their release party. Every single one had drunk the champagne or had it drunk to them, glasses raised and speeches made. Not one could resist the clarion call of celebration, of adoration or worship or whatever they took from the bright, brief glare of attention. Even if it was contempt, they had to see for themselves. But Nova... Nova's voice rose above the racket again, as if in protest, high and ethereal, like a song from another dimension. She was too good for this world, Sean thought. Too good for this room, certainly. This room, the doorway empty, she hadn't come. Nova Tyler was really dead.
He felt the loss deep and personal, like the heavy beat in his gut he used to feel at the shows of his youth when he stood too close to the stage speaker. There was a volume of music that erased melody and ceased to be sound. That skipped the ears entirely and seeped instead through muscle, tissue, and sinew as something physical, all vibration and pulsing electricity, a funeral dirge pounding from inside the bones. Sean tugged at the neck of his shirt. The room was too hot, or the wine had gotten to his head, or... He was thinking of Nova's mother, holding out in silence. He had stared at the woman's beauty mark the whole time he'd made his pitch, avoiding her eyes. If he hadn't truly understood her then, he did now. To go ahead with the release of her daughter's music while she was still missing would have been nothing less than a white flag of surrender, signing away every chance, every hope. He'd sign the divorce papers at the kitchen island with the counter Kayla had wanted, pristine white stone they would have only stained and ruined given the time. Page after page that represented his sins and omissions. When he finished, his arms were numb where they had leaned against the sharp edge of the worktop. The doorway remained empty. She was never going to come, he thought. The catering waitress was there, suddenly catching his wrist as it fell and taking the champagne flute from him just before the dregs splashed towards Les Jenkins. Sean relinquished the glass, grateful, and the waitress gave him a slow wink, long eyelashes grazing at her cheek. She was his age, solid, pretty, and had a twitch of a smile that had seen some things. The cummerbund, the tie, it was a show, and she was in on the joke. He was the punchline. Her lips were moving. Was she asking him something? Nah, she was only singing along with the song under her breath. Les Jenkins was saying something to him, but Sean was caught somewhere between his empty hand and the waitress as she moved away. He had meant to ask her. Sean recognized the loss of the glass weight in his hand. He felt very strange, half in this world, half in another. Was it the music, the booze? He'd hardly had any, distracted, waiting for the woman from Rolling Stone to arrive. He had needed a clear head to... He didn't know. Jenkins leaned closer, his hot breath on Sean's neck. I said, it's too bad she didn't show, Jenkins said loudly. I guess that's that, then, well, heck of a party at least. Sean's mouth was dry. It was too loud, crowded in the gallery, too loud. But overhead, Nova's voice clung to the rafters, dripped from the walls. We'll bust through the gates on the curiosity alone, Jenkins said. The streaming, the downloads, fast before somebody writes a slasher review, or a pile-on stars on social media. Sean felt as though he had somehow slipped into the wrong room. He was somewhere else, sitting across from Nova's mother on a sunken couch. No tour, of course, Jenkins said, sadly. But if Rolling Stone comes through, that might turn things around. Is she here? Sean stared at Jenkins for a moment without comprehension. Who? Who did he mean? Then he spun on his heels, teetering into the highboy table at his elbow, glasses knocked together, and everyone around them reared back. Hey, whoa, Jenkins said, his tone suddenly winking and amused, reacting for the attention that had turned their way. We'll give the speeches, Cutler, if you're half in the bag. Sean pushed him away and scraped the room. He was totally sober. Demi Walters stood at the entrance, peering around the room. Near her, on a tall table, an empty silver tray had been dumped precariously. It had never carried drinks, never had canapes or napkins, or even empty glasses. The waitress, Sean said. Where's that waitress who was just here? Jenkins swirled the dribble left at the bottom of his glass. Everything okay, Sean? At home? I heard a few things around the office, but I didn't want to assume. The waitress! How had she been able to sing along with Nova's song? That unsingable song! And then she winked at him. Her lashes had touched lightly at her cheek, at a dark freckle. They would have. What's that?
Jenkins said, glancing at his watch. They would have called it a beauty mark in the 1940s. Sean had almost said it aloud, nearly the shape of a heart. His hope rose in him, a bubble in a glass, as he imagined racing across the room and through the door to the street, panting. The photos they would all take, the videos, the noise it would all make. He had hope for noise. Noise sold units. Units sold shows, tickets. Tickets unloaded, merch. A new song started up on the sound system. The single, as sweet, as palatable as Nova would ever be. It was mournful, though. A song for a movie's end credits, for a conclusion, for the scene where the hero got what he most wanted. Sean's head buzzed. He could never tell anyone. They would call it a stunt or worse. He had made his gamble, and Nova had made hers. Only one person might have believed him if he hadn't already squandered her trust. Across the room, Demi Walters still stood in her jacket at the threshold of the door, frowning. A bad sign? Or listening with the entire self? As the waitress had, as Nova, honest to God, had, smiling at him. Before the last notes of the single died out, Sean would have to get another glass and a knife or spoon to tap against it to call for everyone's attention, to let that ringing note die out and say, say what? That if one person truly listened and heard, as long as it was the right person, that wink. Maybe he would tell them and risk the fallout, risk being a fool. But he was a fool already. Maybe he would duck out of the speeches entirely and call Kayla. She would want to know. He wanted to tell her. With everything in him, he wanted to be near her again, to play the album for her and watch for her amazement or whatever she would spare him now. Across the room, the woman from Rolling Stone waved to him. Oh, he'd nearly forgotten her. But now she pointed a finger up to the ceiling, toward the music that had somehow risen, lifted above the din, and smiled. Well, folks, that's going to do it for the Mystery Hour. I'm Keith Tyler, no relation to Nova, saying thanks for tuning in. Join me again next time, will you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.